Welcome to the IDTenti podcast number 1035. If you're going to be in Tacoma, Washington, December 12th, 13th, 14th, I will be performing at the Tacoma Comedy Club. So come on out for that. Tickets are online. I think there's still some available, so go on and check it out. Also, we have a bunch of holiday stuff over at IDTenti.com, so pop over there and support the podcast that you're listening to right now, which, by the way, let's get into some corkboard business. Events at id10t.com. From you, the ID10T community, like Blake, who writes, "My friends, Kyle, a visual art director and designer, and Andy, a licensed clinical social worker, just launched a company called Wellmore with the idea to help promote mindfulness and well-being through design. Their first product is the Mindful Planner, a mindfulness-based day planner for 2020, designed to put wellness at the forefront of each day. The layout guides you to prioritize being intentional and present as well as productive and provides space to check in with yourself on how you're feeling physically, emotionally, etc. Prompts for each week include your weekly mantra and scheduling a time for self-care." They did run a successful Kickstarter campaign earlier this year, and they've just started shipping out the first run of planners. And he says, "I'm really excited to see where Kyle and Eddie take the company from here. Thought it was the sort of thing your listeners might be interested in. Who couldn't use more mindfulness and general mental wellness? You can check out more info and purchase a planner at wellmore.co. Thank you. Thank you, Blake." This episode is Dax Shepherd, who I just have to... Well, first of all, he's promoting Armchair Experts, which obviously I'm sure you know is a massive podcast, and also Bless This Mess, which is on Tuesdays at 8:30 on ABC and ABC.com. As you remember, Lake Bell was on just a few weeks back. And so here's the thing with this podcast. It was such an incredibly fun chat. You know, Dax is so thoughtful and funny at the same time. And I'm sure you probably listen to his podcast, so you probably know a lot of this stuff. But here's where, yeah, I'm just apologizing because we recorded this like a year ago. All right, I know, it was a year ago. But sometimes what happens in podcasting is you get an episode and it doesn't have a definitive, like, must go up at this date. So what happens is you just hold on to it because you just have this fear, like, I'm going to run out. I'm going to run out of guests some days, or I'm going to get sick, or I'm going to travel, and then I'm not going to be able to record, and I'm going to need to post something. So you kind of bank a really good episode for a rainy day. But so many rainy days have happened since then that I just just feel terrible. There's only a few things here and there that might suggest that that it was recorded a year ago. But, you know, I listened to it. It doesn't seem dated to me in any way. And so I just, from one podcaster to another, whom I know understands, I'm sorry that this went up a year late. Oh boy. I thought it was recorded like in February. I thought we were only like 6 or 7 months behind, but no, it was a year ago. So Dax Shepherd, I'm sorry, but I love you. And again, I thought since Kristen went up last week, what a fun time to drop the Dax podcast a week later. They are both just wonderful, wonderful people. And was very excited to sit down with them both a year apart. So here's the ID Tangent podcast number 1035, long overdue, with Dax Shepherd.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
No.
Vincent D'Onofrio?
No.
I think it was...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Salt and Sea?
It's something...
I think it's the Salt and Sea.
Is it just called that?
I think so.
It's a great movie.
But they have a real badger in that movie, and it's significantly bigger than that one. And the fucking claws. That's a terrifying animal right there.
It is a terrifying animal because it's, it, you know, like a big animal you can see coming.
Sure.
But those, there's something almost kind of slithery about a wolverine because, or a badger, because their bodies are long.
Yeah.
And
their center of gravity could not be more advantageous.
Yes, and they have that small head, but the fangs and the claws, they're efficiently designed to murder.
That's right. And anything that could sneak up to you from below the knee line is scary.
It's really scary because you can't. Yeah.
As a young kid, we had a. To be honest, I don't even know that we ever got confirmation it was a badger. But we moved into this neighborhood. They'd only built maybe two houses in it. So it was still – there was a field rural aspect to it. And a neighbor kid and I had discovered what we were certain was a badger den, I guess. A big hole in the ground mm-hmm. that we could only explain that it was definitely a badger.
Had to be.
And we spent – many hours at 11 years old with a BB gun leveled
just
at
waiting.
That hole, just ready to defend our property at 11 years old.
not knowing that the BB would do zero damage.
Nothing. It would do nothing but aggravate it and probably
provoke an attack.
Motivate it to, yes, to attack.
I was going
to
leave you alone, but now I'm going to use my hay baler like body to tear through you
yes.
like tissue paper.
And especially at 11, that thing would have fucking gored
us. Oh, there's
us.
No, yeah, yeah, you would not be here.
In fact, when the team of forensic scientists found the corpses and tried to put together what happened, they'd have to conclude that we came across a grizzly bear or something.
At least, yeah. Yes. Well, to a child, a badger is a grizzly bear.
Yes.
You know, to a small...
relative to our size.
And you would have been obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen would have been single her whole life because she never would have found her true love.
Well, I don't. I wouldn't worry about Kristen. I think she would have ended up on her feet somehow. By the way, which is a great – I think it's a very healthy balance in a relationship to know that if things went south, that the other person would be just fine in a week.
Oh.
It's a really healthy –
they'd really just
threat.
Be able to pick right back up.
They would. Like when I think – I only have so much leverage.
Sure.
She'd be totally fine.
Yeah.
And it keeps me honest.
Yeah, I feel the same thing with Lydia too. Like it would be – I feel like logistically mm-hmm. it would be like – if someone bumped into her and she like dropped a Danish on the ground, like, oh, all right, let's brush this off and just go get another Danish.
That's right.
But for you and I, it would be we'd be in the trauma unit.
That's right. That's right. And my saying about her is downward and backward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people say upward and onward. Mine would be downward and backward.
Back and to the left.
Although, the one thing I would have going for me is that I could certainly still date a mid-20s person.
You think so?
Yes. That was like, you know, maybe unsavvy.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't quite realize what a bummer it was going to be being married to me just because they don't have enough world experience. Like I still could get by on the kind of tricking somebody, you know, or false advertising.
Hey, speaking of advertising, you're wearing an Armchair Expert t-shirt.
A live one.
Which is a great, that is a well-designed shirt you're wearing. I like the color. It's sort of a burgundy color.
Thank you.
It's got a nice weave to it.
I've matched it to my shoes, too.
You have matched it to your shoes.
You know what's interesting about me is I dress like a hobo. Yet if you really take some time and study what's happening, there's actually thought behind it,
mm-hmm.
which is, I don't know, kind of embarrassing
fashion,
on some
fashion
level.
Fashion hobo.
Yes, I'm a fashion hobo.
Yeah.
Fashion forward hobo. But yeah, Rob, one of the two producers, he designs the unique shirts for each city we go to live, and I love them. I feel a little weird about wearing a shirt of something that I'm, you know, involved with. You think that's weird?
No, I have a singled out glass that I drink out of sometime.
But don't you think that one is even that's almost now like a meta. It's retro. It's yeah. meta. It's self-deprecating in some way.
There's there's a vintage T-shirt site that I go on every once in a while, and there was a really cool 80s satiny MTV jacket with the MTV logo on the back, and I was so tempted because I felt like enough time has passed that it would be okay.
Yes.
But then at the end of the day, I still just couldn't bring myself to...
Well, and I want to talk to you about this because Please. As I walk through your house, which is beautiful, truly beautiful, you've not gone overboard, but there is certainly a lot of memorabilia in this house and props from things and mm-hmm. old toys you liked.
Yes.
How does one like yourself or Seth Green govern? How do you prevent yourself from being like an episode of Hoarders, where it's just wall-to-wall toys and Star Wars paraphernalia?
You Is get it hard a storage for you? Unit.
Okay, so you don't stop yourself.
You parse it out. Well, I'm the one. I was kind of building a joke that actually was a real thing that happened, where I said to my wife, because my wife is actually kind of a little worse than I am in some aspects with the collecting stuff. Like, I buy a lot of little things, mm-hmm. but she'll, you know, like a box will show up and it's like, oh, there was a Rick Baker auction, so I got this Gremlin. And I said to her, sweetheart, if you don't stop buying horror props, there's not going to be enough room for our vintage taxidermy. I said that as a legitimate sentence.
Yes.
And then had to stop and realize what a perfect relationship this is, that I was with someone who didn't say, like, keep your dumb nerd crap in another house. But actually, so we kind of have to govern each other a little bit.
Yes.
Because Liz will go off she'll go off on tears.
But then, it's a little bit sounds like two co-pilots, both with bad eyesight.
Well, or at least that we have good eyesight, but we both have peripheral issues.
Okay.
But on different sides.
Yeah, you're only seeing the left. She's seeing the right. Together, you have stereoscopic vision.
That's right. Like, yeah. Together, yeah, we need to find each other.
To get that bilateral
vision. But it is fun. I mean, it's, you know, because my theory about all this stuff, particularly with the last giant Disney auction,
I love that you say that as if everyone's aware of the last great Disney auction, or that there are even.
Well, there
Disney
was
auctions.
There was just a massive one.
Because they're in financial.
No. Just this guy named Richard Kraft, who's a lovely guy.
A privateer had been.
Privateer. Okay. He had been collecting for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of the largest, probably the largest single private Disneyland collection.
Okay.
And he had some amazing stuff. And he just sold it all because he was like, it was just time to get rid of it. But he had a ride car from all the rides. Each ride. He had all four stretch paintings. He had, he had like a fucking tugboat from the river cruise.
Yeah.
And he had a ton of great stuff, and he was just like, yeah, it's just time to sell. And, you know, I think he raked in like $7 million.
$7 million.
The auction was nuts. And the reason that I say, like, a lot of people watched it because it was so crazy.
Wait, it was televised?
It was live streamed.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were glued to
it? I was glued to it. I bought a couple things, but nothing massive.
What did you buy?
I bought, Mark Davis was an Imagineer, and I bought original sketches, concept sketches of Disneyland, and they were assembled in like five panels. And the reason that they were assembled is because they were given to the Los Angeles Examiner right before Disneyland opened to sort of show like what was coming. And the Los Angeles Examiner was owned by my wife's great-grandfather. Oh. So I thought it was like a cool piece of Disney and Hearst memorabilia to bring home.
Yes.
So I bought that and a couple small things. But the Disney collection, the auctions for – it's gone so off the deep end because you're bidding against – wealthy nerds from all over the world.
Okay.
And so there were like, you know, Blue Bayou menus from the 80s that were going for like $5,000, like a fucking menu.
Wow.
So other pieces went for $200,000-$300,000.
What was the crown jewel in the collection?
I think the thing that
did he
went
have like
for
a
the
steam powered railroad.
He didn't have engine. That. Okay. He had a Dumbo car. He had like a Dumbo, like one of the Dumbos from the Dumbo ride.
Sure.
And I think that went for like $350,000. I mean, it was just fucking bananas.
And do you have any awareness or idea of who's bidding? You don't. That's all anonymous.
Well, some people like Drew Carey was there bidding on some stuff.
In person.
In person.
Where was it held?
The auction was done by Van Eaton Galleries, which is a place that I bought, you know, a lot of animation sales from, and a lot of the Disney memorabilia comes from there. But there are a lot of like...
How many people were there? Were you in there in person? Or you
know,
you
were watching on the live stream. We were watching on the live stream, and it was fascinating.
But Drew Carey needed boots on the ground. He needed to be
Drew
there.
Drew was there.
To inspect.
And he got some good stuff, too. And Drew won... He won the auction to spend a day at Disneyland with the guy, Richard Kraft. And so he invited us. And so we went and we got to go and we all sort of shared weird, obscure Disney trivia, like walking by different places. And he would point out stuff that I'd never seen before at Disneyland. And we all shared stories about things. It was an incredible, one of my favorite, probably my favorite trip to Disneyland ever, because there was so much. It was like a historical thing, too.
Yes.
And we got to see Walt's apartment. Walt has an apartment above the fire station. I'd never been. And we all got to go up and see it.
You got to go inside. Yeah. And he would sleep there.
Yeah.
Pretty often.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. This was just tiny little.
And so, there's like, so you and I have several friends that are really into this stuff. And I think it's fantastic. But there is always just a little cynical element in my mind. That is, okay, you create this imaginary place and then you're living in this imaginary kind of apartment and you're looking out the window and you're watching people. There's something about it that is a little kind of puppeteery or something. you know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, listen, it's, you know, everything in moderation to a degree. But even though it seems like we don't practice that. But, you know.
Is there anything kinky or perverse about... Like, because I heard he would like often gaze out the window and watch people enjoying his creation, which of course is beautiful and seems altruistic. But is there any part of it that seems perverse to you?
Like controlling in a way? I don't know. I just think, you know.
Like you've basically created Westworld and you're like
yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
They're all going to go sideways like in the Simpsons episode.
You can engineer an experience, which is a weird godlike.
But that's the thing, though. Like, that's what you're doing when you're doing stand-up or writing or creating any kind
yes,
of art.
Yes, and I'd be the first person to say that. We're weirdly perverse and
so
controlling.
To build a life-size, like a world, a life-size diorama that people can go, you know, like live part of their lives in.
Yeah.
I mean, I completely understand why that would be, like, that kind of immersive art experience.
I guess it's just a broader question. If people
and commerce.
Can people create with that level of passion and drive from a place of just altruism, or is there like some damage? Is there a damaged young Walt Disney who needed that safe place?
But
like, it's all kind of compelling to me.
Maybe, but
it doesn't take away from anything.
No,
I'm just curious.
I think anyone who creates anything on a big scale or wants to be a performer or wants to do that. I mean, I think there's probably traces of, you know, broken glass somewhere in their past because, you know, I think trauma or bad thing, like anything that gets you to grow and expand.
Let's just say minimally, if your life is a 10, your need to create an imaginary place where you feel good and life is fun is just way deprioritized.
But
right?
I think it's even bigger than that because if you meet, you know, when I look, any of us who are performers who look back on our childhoods and, you know, whatever sort of problems we had at school or at home or whatever, for me, it was like, you know, just like getting bullied in school for playing D&D and shit like that. It, you know, if I hadn't had that experience, if I hadn't had like a kind of a traumatic school, then I never would have gone inward. I never would have thought to create. I never would have strived to do. Because if you know, people who peak in school and they're just happy and everything's fine and it's great. Maybe they're happy and maybe that's, you know.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of them aren't really conditioned to go like, well, maybe I can make more. Maybe I can create, you know, like build something bigger.
What would be the incentive? What would be the desire? You're not escaping discomfort.
That's why
the great motivator generally is escaping discomfort.
And that's why, you know, I pulled some quotes aside.
I wish
which I don't normally do, but I pulled some quotes aside.
Can I tell you what I wish you were doing?
What?
is queuing up a song you wrote about this.
Like when you just opened that computer, I thought, well, the worst thing that could
trauma
happen
trauma
right
leads
now.
To the best times. Trauma leads to the best ever times.
Oh, that'd
so,
be rough.
Yeah, man. So here's a quote. Where did I put it? But
wait, you've assembled quotes in preparation for me being here, or just in life you've assembled some quotes?
I assembled a quote in preparation for you.
Oh, okay.
To discuss.
Okay.
Because I think here's a
wait,
quote.
Wait, before we move on, though, are you going to take us in another direction?
We're branching off of where we were.
Okay, but before we branch
off. Are you trying to steer my podcast because you're a big podcaster now?
No. Just I've always been arrogant long before. But I do wonder for you and for Seth and for a lot of folks that collect things. I had this experience where I walked into one of my best friend's garages. He's a successful producer. And there was this GT bicycle in the garage. Now, this man is 48 years old. Mm-hmm. He is never going to ride this bicycle. But it immediately, my heart swelled like the Grinch's three times. I was like, where did this GT bike come from? He's like, buddy, I saw it in a window. And I was like, that's the bike I wanted as a kid. And I got it. And now I have it. And we both just stared at this bicycle as if it were like the Holy Grail.
Sure.
And then we started just kind of thinking about, it's interesting. Like, as a kid, you want all that stuff, right? And if you don't get it, as you get older, you're finally like, oh, I can now have all that stuff. And many of us get to accumulate some of that stuff. Or
yes.
Even we transfer it into cars.
And then you get it. And then some people suffer depression afterwards because they think the acquisition of that thing is going to fix them somehow. So I think
Or that they'll get the feeling they wanted in elementary
that's
school.
That's fleeting. That's fleeting. So it really is about shifting your focus to know. And what I was going to say earlier is that we're just curators of this stuff now. Like, it's fun to collect it all because the sum total of it creates a fun story.
Uh-huh.
And the acquisition of it is fun.
Yeah.
As objects, it doesn't define us, and it doesn't, like, if we had to get rid of all of it, yeah, it'd be a bummer, but I don't, but it's like, well, we live. Like, it'd be fine.
And you had the experience.
And we had the experience.
Of hunting for
and so
it.
I feel like we are just curating these things for a while, taking care of them. So when you think of yourself as a curator and less as like I'm an owner and more of like we at this particular period in the time stream are just taking care of these things that are relevant to us in some way.
And I trust you with them.
That's
They're
right.
Better in your house than mine.
And we will pass them along to someone else at some point.
But
you know?
It is a curious thought of how we tend to try to recreate the childhood we wanted at all times when we've got the means to do so.
Yeah, but I think like ultimately really growing up is making peace with that kid.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever done EMDR? It's a form of therapy that is like people with PTSD.
Is this immersion therapy?
I don't think it's called immersion. Okay. I mean, I don't think it's the same as immersion therapy, but I might be wrong. But basically, you know, anything that you're working on, like, I feel insecure when I meet new people. And then the therapist, like, it seems silly, but you put these things in your hands that vibrate at different intervals.
Okay.
And the theory behind it is that you're sort of rebuilding neural pathways.
Okay.
And so they'll say, you know,
is this not vaguely related to how you get audited in Scientology? No, I say that sincerely.
Well, this didn't cost $50,000.
Oh, okay.
So, and so they'll say, like, what's the first, you know, the earliest memory you have of feeling this way? And then so you dredge up, you know, like I had this experience where it was like about perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's the earliest memory where you felt like frustrated that something wasn't perfect? And I started telling the story like, oh, when I was a kid, you know, my dad was a professional bowler and I bowled as a kid. And then I stopped and I burst out laughing and the therapist said, oh, what's so funny? And I said, well, we're talking about perfectionism. I said, what do you call it when you get a 300 in bowling? And she goes, oh, it's a perfect game. And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
So this game that I was conditioned from earliest childhood.
There actually was a perfect.
There was a, like, unlike most sports.
Or
there,
anything.
There is a perfect goal. And if you fuck up anywhere in the game, it's ruined.
Yes.
And how frustrating that is. And so.
If you're in pursuit of a 300.
If you're in pursuit of a 300.
If you just want to buzz and to meet some other divorcee.
Well, that's the thing. It's like,
you're
why? are you, why are you doing it? You know, like, how do you define success? And so, yeah, so that's, it's sort of like, the goal isn't really the goal. The process is the goal.
Yes, yes.
What kind of gum are you to? Is it
no, those are nicotine lozenges.
Oh.
So a very trusted brand, Thrive, from Canada. The American ones give me gas.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. But these, no farts.
None at all.
No, nope, I got them on a press tour in Toronto, and I've never looked back. That was probably 3 years ago.
And you, so you don't smoke?
No. I haven't for 13 and a half years.
But have you been doing nicotine gum or
for 11 of those years. I did go off them for 2 whole years, and then I found literally 4 in an old nightstand, and I told Chris, and I presented it as if I had found like a bag of cocaine in the house. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, hun, so I found 4 lozenges, and I'm going to do 2 today, and then I'm going to do 1 and tomorrow then, and 1 the next day.
And then 10,000 over the next
and
years.
I like pitched that to her, and she's like, yeah, okay, because as can happen, if you're not an addict, it's hard to comprehend how that's not possible for
right.
me. Because it sounded like I had a great game plan, yeah. And I did.
Yeah.
And then after that last one on the 4th day, I was like, go up to Rite Aid and get 168 of them, which is exactly what I did, and no, that is was it, so 5
not,
years ago.
It's not unhealthy at all to
It is not. And I'll tell you, there is some compelling evidence that there are some benefits of nicotine. Now, what is unhealthy about nicotine is it does raise your overall, your heart rate and your blood pressure. So if you are someone that is prone to hypertension, it's not good for you. I have low to moderate blood pressure, so that's not an issue. The upside is there's a few studies that show it prolongs the onset of both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, I look at it as like kind of a
so
vitamin.
It's a win-win.
It's
you
a
get,
vitamin.
It is. It's a daily vitamin that you take
12 times
8 to
a day.
10 times.
It's a 12 times. Can you imagine if you bought a vitamin, you read the back of it, and it's it take 12 times daily?
What the fuck?
Take every 45 minutes.
Are you sure? Yeah, that's what it said.
Yeah, I would go, well, no, that's crazy. I'm not going to commit to this.
It just it said, yeah, take 12 times a day. Administer liberally until buzz wears off.
Yes, until agitation resumes. And then pop a couple back.
So here's a quote from Seneca. Here's a quote from Seneca.
Who's Seneca?
Seneca was a philosopher.
Okay.
And in the realm of Stoicism, and he said, "I judge you unfortunate because you have never lived through misfortune. You have passed through life without an opponent. No one can ever know what you are capable of, not even you."
Mm.
Which I think is a nice quote, because basically it's that idea of like, you have to fuck up and you have to go through things in order to grow and evolve and be better. And if you don't, then I think you peak in high, you know, you, which is again, that's fine.
Yeah.
If you don't, you know, if you don't have the nipping pterodactyls of neurosis
I love that in
at your feet,
culture, we have to say everything's fine. Like, yeah. Look, if you peaked out in high school and now you're an alcoholic and you're nearing death at 48 from health decisions and you left your wife, that's fine.
You're fine.
That's fine. We're no judgment.
Because one person will be like, hey, I'm 48 yes. and I peaked early yes. and I had serious substance abuse problems and then my wife left me and and how dare you?
Yes, we're no longer allowed to be any turn objective about what could or be not be a life with less suffering and more flourishing.
Well, now, and I'm sure now that you're learning more, let's talk about this because...
No, let's talk about the quote. Let's talk. I hijacked you. Let's talk about... I like this quote.
Okay.
So what I want to say about that quote is...
Yes.
A lot of people are impressed with people like you and I who came from modest means and accomplished something that is societally seen as, you know... impressive.
You mean marrying outside what we should have been capable of?
Well, certainly, yes, outside of our caste.
Yeah.
But what I find to be 3 times as impressive as that is the rare occasion when I meet a legitimate trust fund child who has accomplished a ton of stuff and mm-hmm. is super motivated and driven.
Yeah.
Like when I look at Julia Louise, right?
Mm-hmm.
I
Julia Louis right. Dreyfus?
Julia Louis Dreyfus. She is heir to the Dreyfus fortune, which mm-hmm. is in excess of $1 billion. So when I watch her on Seinfeld, I go, wow, not only is she, I think, the funniest female actress ever. I mean, I'm so blown away with her talent. But then I go, on top of that, she didn't have to do anything. It's,
well, it's
so
also,
impressive.
But, you know, that idea of when someone has money, they don't have to do anything is bunk. Because people, you'd go crazy if you didn't do anything. Like, we are born to do things.
Yes.
Because we have, and when people don't, then they become rudderless, they become depressed, they become, you know, it's because we have to contribute. Like, we need this idea that's like, well, why does this guy have to keep working? He's got money, or why does that lady? It's like, they're not working for money. You know, it's like people are working to
self-esteem and productive.
And she, you know, but that's so much money that it's almost like no money.
But I just think it's a lot easier for you and I who, if not now, at least at one time, wanted all the tangible shit. Like, I want a house. I want a car I like. I want health insurance. Whatever the thing is, like, I had a very... a hot furnace inside that propelled me because I wanted shit. And I just wonder if I had all that stuff, just how driven I would have been. Like, I certainly was in pursuit. Now it's evolved and changed, and I've now realized those things I wanted didn't really fill the hole or give me the contentment I was looking for. But for many years, I was convinced a speedboat would cure all my ails, you know?
Well, yeah. And, you know, Lydia's family, like, when she was growing up, they, you know, it was like, you're not going to turn into an asshole. You're going to work. You're going to work. And so, like, she worked her ass off and created all this stuff. And, and it wasn't.
But you have to begin. You have to be crazy mindful if you're starting with tons of privilege and advantage to get that outcome.
Right.
You can be a terrible parent and have a kid that's just driven and hungry and wants all the shit that they don't have, and they'll do fine. It takes an extra, I think, an extra dose to turn a kid out who's rich well.
But any, you know, all humans are just a weird chemistry experiment, and some of them go right, you know, with seemingly incorrect ingredients, they go right, and someone who seems to have all the correct ingredients can go, you know, can explode.
Yes.
So it just, we're just all weird chemistry experiments, and it, you know, it's like there's so many things that go into a person.
Well, that's
just
why we can't discover a single thing about what makes us healthy. It's almost impossible to figure out what makes humans healthy, because we're the worst things, we're the worst subjects in a science experiment. Because there's so many things we're doing. There's so many things we're eating. There's so much happening.
We want an answer of just like, oh, if we just take this thing.
Are beans good for you? You know, but
yes, they are. And then a year later, it turns out beans are not. Yeah, no, they're good again.
Unless you're going to sequester like 1,000 human beings and make them only eat beans, you just can't find out the answer to that question.
Right.
Or just even the notion that we, up until very recently, you know, that they did not do clinical trials with females. Did you know this? I had no idea that this was. It was a 60-minute segment, which was fascinating. What they started. Thank you for adding. Thank you, Fred Norris.
That's the clock.
Women were having this inordinately strong reaction to Ambien, which was curious. They were at a much higher rate blacking out, going to the store and buying candy, all these weird things that are now associated with too much Ambien.
Right.
And what they figured out is that women, for whatever reason, chemically react twice as strong as men do. So their dosage has to be half of what
men
do. And
so they did no clinical trials?
But they didn't know it because they don't do clinical trials with women because the long-standing explanation is that women have a period once a month, which makes them bad test subjects.
Which industry is this?
the medical research field historically doesn't use women because they have a period.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and that's now being changed. But there's all this medicine that's never been.
What if they're testing period medication? Testing on dudes. Yeah, I haven't had a period in like 35 years.
Yeah, yeah. It works. Yeah, presumably they've been doing female-only products with females.
And how horrible is that for these poor women who thought.
Well, their defense, and again, I'm not saying they were correct, but what they would say is, okay, well, if you're monitoring things like mood and what's the reaction, so there's going to be a few days of the month where their mood is going to be altered by their menstrual cycle. So that the data there is kind of blown. They're also bleeding for a few days of the month, which kind of throws everything out of whack. I don't think the founding argument was preposterous. I just think we now realize that we can't have it that way.
I mean, still, it just sounds like a thing created by
the
dudes.
Patriarchy.
Well, yes.
But why wouldn't the patriarchy want to study women? I would way rather have a group of 1,000 women I'm studying than a bunch of dudes.
I don't know.
You think their own selfish motive would be to be surrounded by women?
And then, so then what happens at that point? Are they just like, so sorry for all the weird blackouts?
Virtually, that's
ladies,
what happened.
Sorry?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I can only assume there's got to be some class action shit because
I know different. I have females in my life who are like, I woke up and I no memory. I went to 7-Eleven. I have like 12 Twizzler, empty Twizzler.
That to me is more horrifying than being stalked by a Wolverine. Is waking up with time that you can't account
with
for.
With clues later yes, around. It's like memento.
Yes, exactly. It's like, where did this Fun Dip come from?
Yeah.
And why do I have half-opened beef jerky?
This punched ticket from a county fair.
Why are these Slim Jims in the microwave? What happened?
Yeah, that's very scary.
I'm not a fan of that, which is why, you know, I don't take anything. I mean, I imagine you probably don't either.
Yeah, so I never did. I had a very, very strict rule about I didn't want any Ambien, Xanax I would never want a prescription for. But this year I started doing a sitcom where I have a live audience show on Friday night. And I already have a horrendous time falling asleep. So for me to get to bed on time, I got to start my little routine at like 9 o'clock at night. And right. All these things have to fall perfectly in order for mm-hmm. me to fall asleep. So now I'm doing a live show that I get out of at 10 o'clock at night. And I probably drank caffeine to be awake for the live show. And then the show itself gives me tons of energy. And I come home like best case scenario, I'm winding down in 6 hours, which is that's a deal breaker. I have two little right. kids that wake up very early Saturday morning. I can't have that. So as a supervised experiment, I tried Ambien. And my wife is in charge of the Ambien to make sure I only get one Ambien. Mm-hmm. And it did put me to sleep in a good short period of time. But then my problem with this is I just wake up 4 hours later and mm-hmm. I'm wide awake.
Right.
And what am I going to take, a second one midnight?
Right.
So in general, no, I don't take anything, but that's, I want to be honest and say I have on show nights this last year. And then also a couple times where like I get out of the show, I have a live show in Brooklyn the next day and I know I have to sleep on that airplane for 5 hours. I have my wife send me to the airport with one.
You know, the other solution is to maybe just take it easy every once in a while.
But let me ask you this, though. Yeah. You're right. I could quit this TV show.
Well, that you probably aren't going to do.
I'm not going to do that.
No.
Yeah. So like any other lazy American, I'm going to look for a pharmaceutical solution to a lifestyle yeah. issue.
You're going to look for a pharmaceutical to smash that square peg into the round hole of your life.
That's right. And on the 15 shows last year that I employed that method, it kind of worked.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, because your podcast – completely exploded in the best way.
Really hard for me to comprehend.
I mean, I remember when we were talking about it. I remember doing it in a half-built garage.
Well, it's still there.
Okay, good.
Yeah, yeah. I hope it'll always be there.
And
you gave me great advice that I used.
And it's you know, and I am jealous. I mean, I get how you got them, but I'm jealous of Ted Danson. Ted Danson is a dude that I've always had on my list of like, I fucking want that. I've been watching every night because I wake up in the middle of the night too and I watch an episode or two of Cheers.
Because you don't have kids.
I don't have kids.
Again, if I didn't have kids, I'd ride out all this shit. But it is not an option. You cannot deal with a 3 and 5 year old on 4 hours
Why
of sleep.
Why don't they appreciate that you have needs? It seems very selfish
They're
to me.
They're 20 years away from recognizing me as a human being if it ever happens.
If that ever happens.
I explain stuff to them all the time. Like my 3 year old will literally kick me straight in the fucking nose intentionally. And I'll go, honey, daddy's a human like you. Like, there's a limit to how much pain I can endure.
So how do you – I mean, obviously, you have to
– kick them back.
Daddy can kick hard, too, it turns
Hammurabi's
out.
Code, eye for an eye.
Nose for a nose.
Yeah, whatever it takes.
And now it's never happened again. It's never happened again.
Yeah.
But how do you discipline a child when they are – when they're not just testing boundaries, but like smashing windows to try to understand like what's okay and what's not okay.
Well, look, I don't have it figured out because I'm in the process of it. Mm-hmm. And there are techniques. What compounds the frustration of raising children is that I have two of them and they require two entirely different approaches. It's like when you've been on a set and there's a director and the poor director's got to figure out how to talk to Lauren Graham and me. And we both like completely opposite ways of being talked to.
Right.
And so you quickly find out when you have a second kid that she's like a completely different person. The 3-year-old's much like me. Any rule you give her, that's almost the, that becomes the North Star of what to do. Mm-hmm. You know, she just loves to break rules and that's how she is. So it's like, yeah, learning how to outmaneuver her is a pretty full-time job. And what's interesting is I had Rob McElhenney on. Have you ever had him on? Yeah. So I love Rob, and he was discussing taking his oldest son to a kind of behavioral therapist. I don't even know if they took him, but he and the wife went. And the therapist said, listen, you don't need to tell your son not to hit his brother. He knows that. He knows that. You don't need to tell him that. What he needs is you to be on his side in that moment and say, God, you must be so frustrated if you want to hit your brother, because he already knows he's not allowed to. Tell me how that feels. Like, just always be on his side. He knows the rules. And just
what
to hear,
comes up with a really compelling reason for why he's doing it, then do the parents have to go, he's got us on a loophole.
I guess. By the way, that would, best idea wins in my household. We get hoisted all the time by our own petard, because if they make a good enough argument, I want to reward that. Like, they live in a, they live in an environment where the truth is the truth, which is hard as a parent. Because if they, if I say there's no TV because of blank, and they point out that that's inconsistent with the rule I established a month ago, I'll say, you're right, and I'm going to stick with that rule. So they do win arguments with me.
I'll allow it. You have to.
I'll allow it.
You have to be a judge on a crime case. Yeah. I'll allow it.
It stands.
Sustained.
Sustained, yes. Yeah,
so, you're free to go.
And weirdly, McElhenney's background is he went to a Jesuit school.
Oh, me too.
You did too?
Yeah.
And the more I've now had more and more guests that have had that upbringing, and I'm very against parochial, is that what you call it? Religious-based school. Just in general, theoretically, I don't. I'm a secularist. So, but everyone I've had on that had a Jesuit education seems to be better because of it.
Some people...
And isn't there the best idea wins?
I do know people... Well, yeah, I mean, but I also know people that had very bad experience. I mean, I happen to have a great experience.
Mm-hmm. But is my understanding correct that if you make a compelling argument, you're encouraged to question rules?
I felt that way. I know people who had different Jesuit experiences, but I went to two Jesuit schools because we moved partway through high school. We moved from
Florida to Colorado,
Denver to LA.
Oh, I got one of them right.
Yeah, you got half of them. Yeah,
and I interviewed you like a year ago. So
yeah,
I'm kind
so
of impressed.
Fine. That was February. Yeah, I guess last year. But what I remember about the Jesuit education is that they very much spoke to us like people and not like that we were all equal and not down at us.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we're just sort of very open and seem to understand our vernacular. And yes, I mean, there were certainly boundaries that you couldn't break. And that was the tricky part.
But you got a day in court, right?
You did. But that was the tricky part, was that when they spend a lot of time, you know, making you feel like you're on the same level, then when you like violently break a rule because you think you're in, and then you realize like, whoa, and then, you know, sometimes the boundaries just come like crashing down, and then you learn.
There's a little dissonance at
it wasn't corporal punishment. But it was like we just had to, you know, we had detention.
But would you argue though that it was minimally just? Like that when you broke that one that reminded you of your place in the system, was at least the rule just? Because I think that's where it all lies.
I think it was. I mean, I never it was – the trick is when you allow your students to talk very freely, it's easy to get – mouthy.
Sure.
Because you sort of feel like, oh, well, like, you know, the priests swear and I, you know, like they're mouthy, so I can be, you know, so there still is a little bit of separation.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of learn to navigate it. But I really like, I liked it. I liked studying a dead language, Latin. I liked that it was, I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it. I really did. When I have a kid, I mean, I don't know if I would force them to go to Jesuit school. I would probably, you know, like take them around and see what they liked. But also,
well, again, if and when you have kids and you have more than one, what's so fascinating is there isn't a decision that works for the family. It's like, I can tell you right now that my oldest daughter should in no way be being taught the way my younger daughter is going to have to be taught. It's just so clear. There's no way that whatever system would work for the older one would also work on the younger one, because they're opposites. Like the eldest loves rules, can't wait to do it exactly as prescribed, and looks forward to the positive result of that. the 3-year-old's just an anarchist. She, you know, so there's no way.
Well, I guess,
and it starts becoming obvious, like, why the education problem in the country is such a hard problem to overcome, because you're not going to walk into a school and like lay down the system that works. You know, we're all so unique and different.
But I also think there is that sort of middle ground, because if you cater too much to every individual, which of course we are all being conditioned through algorithms on the internet, everything is personally catered to our every whim.
Yeah.
Then it doesn't really teach us how to fit into a community, because we expect every community to wrap around us.
Yeah.
And that's not a very realistic expectation.
I agree with you. And I have the same thought, which is, no, quite often in life, you just have to get with the fucking program. And my kids got to understand that. But I had recently this Harvard professor on who wrote a book called either The Failure of Normal or something like this. And basically, after studying many different things, one of them being cockpits of F-16s, that they had been created for the mean height of an American, right, male, and that when you create systems and products that are supposed to service the mean, you end up just statistically excluding the majority.
Sure.
So you're almost better off creating the plane for either tall people or short people, because weirdly, just numbers-wise, more people fall outside of the mean than they do within the mean. So there's all these counterintuitive things. And his point, because I said that about the classroom, I'm like, well, kids got to get with the fucking program. And he said, sure, I understand that. But when you look at that, a second grade class is designed for the kids to read at a second grade level, and you actually go in and look at the numbers, what you're finding is that almost half the kids are reading above that level and half are reading below. So it's failing everyone, because the kids that are above it don't want to read at that level, and the kids that are below it can't read at that level. He's like, so all you're doing by get with the program is you're just leaving tons of people behind. That's just the reality.
Well, but it depends on what the program is. If the program is defined as the mean, then yes.
But his argument is like, why isn't there variable instruction? We have the technology. Kids could learn on an iPad. The iPad can assess quite quickly what a kid's reading aptitude is.
And that's probably up to the teachers, because I think it's probably just enough for a teacher to manage the students that they have, much less – you know, having to create individualized.
They can't. That's right. Clear. But we have technology to create a system that can. It already exists. There's already a name for the program. It's just not being implemented.
It's called Skynet.
Yeah. And I totally agree with you. I can barely handle being in the house all day long with just two. I do, when I drop them off at kindergarten, I can't believe that human's willing to sit in that classroom with 25 of them. It's really admirable.
But let's talk a little bit about your podcast, because I want to hear what you've learned in this last almost year, you know, because your show grew meteorically. You have fantastic guests and the depth of the conversation is great. And so having talked to you before and then during, and then, you know, now we're here, what have you learned? How have you evolved, and what are you taking away from the experience?
Well, let me start by saying, I am very used to working really hard for 2 years on a movie and then it failing. That's my experience. My association with hard work is basically 3 underwhelming movies. So it's very foreign for me to put in much less time and to have my very first kind of hugely successful thing. I've never really been in movies that were hugely successful. So this is the most unique feeling I've ever had. I mean, it blows my mind that so many people listen to it. But hourly, I have gratitude for it. Lucky for me, you were one of my first 10 guests, I think. And unlike me, I had the humility to ask you advice. And you gave me a couple of great pieces of advice that I have implemented, not fully, but in the way that's safe for me. So one thing you said to me was, don't research. Your suggestion was don't research. I can't get there because I always just think, if for some reason the magic doesn't happen, I have to get them to some milestones that hopefully will trigger something. So I have some awareness. But certainly I cut it by about 80%. And your theory behind why, which I thought was – I had already seen was happening, was –
You research them. You find out this amazing story. They were attacked in a grocery store. You then try to lead the conversation to the story that hopefully they'll tell about getting attacked in the grocery store. You are no longer interested in the story because you're just trying to get them there.
Right. It's like take check you in the moment.
Yes. And so your argument was you're just far less interested if you already know what's going to be said versus being surprised. Like, you have to open yourself up to being surprised and to let the thing flow. So that just takes confidence from having done it. So I do think – I think we've done 70 episodes now, and I think I've made just slow progress towards – I have almost zero anxiety when I sit down. I'm now in a spot where I'm like, oh, something will happen.
And you can roll with it.
Yeah. And I – that has helped me talk less. Also, when you did the show, we didn't edit. So when you were on the show, anytime there was 12 seconds of silence, I'm panicking. Because I'm thinking, you can't just have silence.
You're not on, but it's different. You're not on stage. If you have 12 seconds of silence on stage, it's death.
You're dead.
Yeah.
You I should mean, just walk out.
Like in an improv scene, you know?
Yes. Or a sketch. You should not hear 12 seconds of silence in any kind of performance arts and comedy. So, you know, once I incorporated that we edit, then for me, the pressure of having wall-to-wall stuff went down, and then I could get a less controlling about the whole conversation, and that's helped a ton. But then we've started doing live shows, which is its own fun mm-hmm. thing that then requires another level of like, oh, it's going to go fine.
Yeah.
Here's somebody who's maybe never been in front of 2,000 people, but I'm just going to believe that they're not going to shut down in this situation because I'm going to try to lock into them.
But that's what you're there to do is, you know, especially with the live show, you're sort of half with the guest and half with the audience because you're playing to the audience a little bit.
100%.
And it just creates a lot more energy. I think our first live show was Adam Savage, maybe?
Okay.
At Largo in like 2010.
Uh-huh.
And it was really early on. I was like, oh, why couldn't we just go do this at, you know?
Yeah.
And we had a musical performance, and it created such a fun dynamic. And that's when I realized, like, oh, a podcast can be anything. Like, it doesn't matter what it is as long as it's interesting to you.
Well,
it's good for the listener.
My breakthrough is going to see Sam Harris and Steven Pinker at, is it? Kodak Theater right here in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I went and saw Sam Harris at Kodak Theater, completely sold out. I think that's 3,500 people watching two scientists talk, you know, in a monotone voice about stats.
Mm-hmm.
And I was riveted, as were the 3,500 people. And I thought, well, Jesus, if this is a if this podcast can be live, then I think ours can be.
I mean, I have a and you also get to think like, I do have some live stage performance experience in my
100%.
Background. But that's why it's great is that you're pulling every facet of your personality. Like, your podcast is everything that you've learned up to that point in any discipline all pulled together. And the more specific it is, the more unique it is, and ultimately the more interesting it is, I think. So every facet of you...
You're so right. It's like I got on that stage... I think our first show was at Largo as well. And I thought, oh my God, that hasn't been since the Groundlings that I had this. I remember this push and pull with the audience and how fun it is to be dialed in with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, picking it up, bringing it down, all those things. It's so fun. And yeah, to your point, the idea that the podcast somehow facilitated me being on stage in front of a ton of people. It's just like the happiest miracle of all of it because I 10 years ago, I was like, well, I'm not going to join an improv group and I'm not going to join a sketch comedy group. I'm going to start doing stand-up. And I did that for a couple of years and it was fun, but it wasn't kind of what I wanted it to be. And this weirdly is that.
It is, and it's like any, you know, like any great job or any great relationship or any great anything, which is in your mind, you think like, oh, I have to do something. And then but then when it works, it's so effortless that you almost don't take it seriously. You feel guilty, but you almost don't take it seriously because you're like, well, this isn't anything. This is just me fucking around. It's like, yeah, but it's effortless.
Yes.
You know, when you're in a good relationship, it's effortless. When you're in a good, any situation and you're not doing, you're just so dialed into it that you're just being.
Yeah, not to be corny, really, but like you're in flow.
I would call it ubiquitous among successful comedians, which is there is this weird sense of guilt. I think it's why you see so many successful comedians go into drama, because there's something about it being as easy as it is that feels fraudulent, or like you don't deserve that acclaim or the amount of money you're making or all these things. Like I, for me, on the outside, diagnosed Jim Carrey with this, which is like the level of support and fandom that comes from him doing what he's done in a mirror his whole life. Probably felt like he wasn't working hard enough or something, or he didn't deserve that amount of money or those amount of fans.
Maybe that's some of it, but I also think that the transition of comedy to drama is that comedy, I think, is a deeper level of drama,
mm-hmm.
because inside every joke pretty much is something tragic.
Sure.
You know, comedy is a defense mechanism, so it forces you to be more hyper aware of your drama, your trauma, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I wouldn't define comedy and drama as two separate things. I'd think comedy is a deeper level of drama.
But in the simplest terms, they hand out an award at the Oscars for the best actor.
That's right.
And it's never once gone to a comedian for... I mean, if anyone should win an Oscar, whatever year Ace Ventura came out, it should be him. He did something no human being can do. Literally, no, you can't recast Ace in Ace Ventura. So certainly within the community, it's not being seen as something that warrants an award, right? Or that you didn't go through this heartbreaking pathos to become Abe Lincoln like fucking our boy did.
Dan Lewis. Yeah. Dan.
So.
Abra-Dan.
I think a lot of successful comedians walk around with a little bit of like, oh, is this like, am I a fraud? Or is this, I don't know. I just feel like there's some level of guilt associated getting a lot of reward for something that's very easy for you to do.
I think most people who get a lot of reward have a bit of the imposter syndrome, regardless of what it is, because it's very difficult to imagine.
You think Dan Lewis does?
I think Danny has a little bit. I don't know if Dan has.
I don't think he does.
I think maybe he does not.
Yeah. If I had to bet, let's just say.
Unless he were playing a character with it, and then he would fully immerse in it, and then he would have it. But yes. He is a person. I think he probably doesn't have it. But I think, you know, most people, because it's very difficult to imagine ourselves in in that type of a scenario. We all have a comfort zone. And whether you fall below that zone or you exceed that zone, you know, people have an idea of what they think they deserve, and it probably goes back to childhood, and they probably would benefit from doing some type of EMDR to forgive their child, you know, to tell their tiny self, like, you're enough.
Yeah.
Because that's basically what I think we're looking for a lot of is just, am I enough? Am I enough? And if you could go back in time to tell tiny you, like, you're enough.
Yeah.
You know, like, that would solve so many problems. But then maybe we wouldn't have great art. So maybe we need to not be enough to generate art to let other people know that they can be enough.
Well, the kind of great paradox of it all is I am someone who, at the same time, has this enormous sense of entitlement. That I think I could do any of this stuff. Like, I have what a sense of entitlement I have. And yet I have a self-loathing side that doesn't think I deserve any of the things I get. It's like, I think I deserve everything.
And then once I get the curse,
I think I don't deserve any of it. So it can all be happening at the same time.
Well, and then of course, what I think, I just think, you know, I might be dead. And, you know, if I'm lucky, I'll live another 30 years.
Right.
Maybe 35 years.
Agreed.
And so I'm starting to get to this point where it's not like I don't give a shit, but I guess I sort of feel like it's not going to matter. Like, you know, there's this sort of, and again, I think that's why I've been so interested in stoicism lately. It's just like, it's just that sort of like dust in the wind philosophy of like, yeah, you know what? Just enjoy your time. Enjoy the process of it. It's like the things that I'm stressing about, they're not going to fucking matter. And it doesn't matter how many Disney collectibles I collect. Like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
I'm going to die. I will be dead someday and completely insignificant and forgotten, you know? And there's a weird comfort in that. I don't mind that at all. We're just a part of this machine, and that's fine. And so that's very helpful.
My saying that I hope I created, that I kind of say to myself as a mantra, is just like, we're just all monkeys trying to stay busy till we die. That's really how important it all is.
Yeah.
We're just, if you were in a spaceship watching us, you'd be like, oh my God, how cute. They've made little cars they drive around.
Look, he thinks he's, people.
They're all racing to some place. And when they get there, they're doing what they think is the most important thing. Like, it would be adorable to be viewing from above.
He put a Wolverine in his house just to look at it, not to eat it, not to defend himself from it, just to look at it.
Oh, that guy talks into a stick all day, and that's how he seems to have gotten all this stuff. Like, the whole thing is silly.
Well, he collected a bunch of stuff from one amusement park and put them all together in one space.
Beautiful. Adorable. Waste of time. Yeah.
What a fucking moron.
Yeah. So
how cute.
I try to keep that in perspective. Or I had Jay Leno on the other day, and he was saying that he was in Vegas, and he saw three guys carrying an Elvis statue. And he said, where are you guys putting that up? And they said, no, we took it down. He's like, why'd you take it down? And they said, oh, no one knows who Elvis is. Like, no 20-year-olds really know who Elvis is. And they took down an Elvis statue.
Oh, my God.
And Jay said, well, Jesus Christ.
What chance don't know do who I have?
Is zero. You have fucking zero chance if you're, you know, if an Elvis statue can't stay up. In fight him?
That's just how it happens. You know, my mom's dog will he vacillates between taking all of his toys out of the bed and arranging them in certain ways and then putting them back in the bed. And it's just like, and we look at him and go, what an adorable weirdo.
Yes.
What a dope.
Yeah.
And that's basically,
and then
just,
you proceed through your day doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine. We're all just, you know, like playfully killing time, which is fine.
To me, the that sounds abstract, I think, if I were to just have heard you say that when I was 36. But I think for me, what it's really, where the rubber meets the road is, it's really uncoupling my ego and identity from all these things. Because that's the thing that as a human you will try to preserve at all costs. You'll go to war over that, your identity, And so the less I think of myself as having a career versus I have a job, just that little distinction for me. A career is a very lofty thing, and you're going to evaluate its totality, and that's going to inform your narrative self. A job's a fucking place you show up and do something at.
Yeah, this is a fun distraction that I get to do.
100%.
Because the ego decisions are the highest highs and the lowest lows.
Mm-hmm.
And when you make decisions solely based on ego, they're usually the first things that get knocked down and the things that topple the hardest.
Yeah.
And they're the hardest to recover from until you just say, like, nah.
You're also giving a lot of power to something you ultimately have
zero.
A marginal level of control over.
I'd say
you have total control over how good of a husband you are, how good of a parent you are.
That's stoicism. What you're talking about is stoicism. Like, that's
I keep stumbling upon things that I find out are already things. Like, I'm listening to this podcast, Leaving Nexium. Have you heard that?
No.
Oh, it's so tasty. Have you heard of it? It's Nexium was this kind of self improvement thing, kind of like ESP or Landmark Forum. And
it's not like a GERD drug, a acid reflux drug.
No. That there is one called Nexium.
Okay, this is
a
program.
Much different. Yes, this is a self improvement program read by this guy Keith Vanieri or something. What you'll remember about it is that the lead girl on Smallville became very high up in it.
Oh, this is that thing,
yes,
where the guy just
within
got
it. Within Nexium, there was a sex cult called DOS, and she has been arrested and is being tried for sex trafficking, as is Keith. And at any rate, the podcast
is fascinating.
I didn't
realize that's what that was. Yes, I've heard of that.
And this, his main subject was in for 13 years and left, so she's a great source of everything that really happens in there. But all that to say, when they're going through what the process of Nexium is, I'm realizing, oh, this is my total philosophy on life.
But just not weaponized.
Yeah,
but yours isn't weaponized.
Mine isn't weaponized, nor am I the leader of my thought process. But I was shocked to go like, oh, that's so weird. That's almost exactly what I believe, and I didn't read it anywhere in a book. But I guess they just came to the same conclusion.
But there are some things that are timelessly true about humanity, and you can package them however you want, and add whatever sort of ornamentation or cup holders, religion or whatever it is. But when you strip it down,
I do think the basics of it are, you know, don't be a dick. You can't control what happens in the world, but you can control how you react to the world. And those are the those are the foundational elements, I think, of most things.
Yeah.
But it's just that, you know, we do like to sort of complicate things and attach higher levels of identity to them. And so it's just all presentation and story. It's like, what storybook path do you need to get to that same little town?
Yes.
And that's really what it is.
Well, one of their most fundamental beliefs is that people can't make you feel any way.
Right.
Which I 100% agree with.
I agree with that too.
I battle with Monica quite often, my co-host, about that. Even if she'll phrase like, he made me feel blank or that made me. I'm like, that's just not how it is. Like, that happened and then you felt a certain way because of your baggage. And
well, some people feel like their reactions are beyond their control. They react right to something and go, well, it's like, yeah, but you set up the conditions to have that reaction. The choice was so fast. It was a micro choice.
You could follow a very specific plan to never have that reaction again. It's actually within you to do so. Because what you find you're really reacting to at most times is your insecurities. So I could stand in front of 200 people that were shouting at me all the time. You're puny. You're a miniature little. You're too short. Hey, shorty. It could go on and on indefinitely. But I have no fear of being short.
I'm almost 5'10". I thought you were.
I'm 6'3".
Okay, all right. Yeah,
I have zero fear of being short. So it doesn't really matter how many times you try to insult me for being short. It'll have no impact on me. But solely because – not because I'm objectively tall. That's not actually it. It's because I have no fear of being short.
Right.
There are other things that you could just – mildly suggest about me and I'll freak the fuck out because I have a big fear of it.
Yeah, and it's also like where people are willing to sort of take responsibility for whatever. It's like, you know, when people try to do the, why, you know, I was drunk, so I don't know. It's like, yeah, but who made the decision? Yeah. You know, it's like...
Who got you drunk?
You have to understand when you set up the conditions for something, then you set up the dominoes for that to fall down. Like if you're, you know, if you get... short with people or, you know, it's like, well, yeah, okay, maybe you were tired, but why were you tired? Was it because you stayed up late playing video games and you did this, you made this choice. And so it's like you make these micro choices along the way that you don't even realize you're making because you just sort of – you're set on autopilot.
Yeah.
And you're led around by whatever is pleasurable to you in the moment, and that's where the power lies.
And you should also just start by acknowledging to yourself that there are two variables in every equation. You're one of them, and then there's someone else, or there's 10 other people. And you must first acknowledge you're the only variable in any equation you have any say over. So you just have to admit that there's only one piece of the equation that you'll ever have the power to change, which is yourself. So just knowing that.
I might have another quote for you.
Oh, fuck. I just queued you up beautifully.
You just queued me up for another quote.
Is this quote thing new?
No,
I remember it on my two previous.
No, it was. It's not a thing that's going to be a thing. It's just that
we need to give this a name and package.
I know. I know how philosophical you. Let's see.
Someone's going to upset.
Okay, here we go. This is Epictetus.
Okay,
a pillar of Stoic philosophy. The chief task in life is simply this, to identify and separate matters so that I can say clearly to myself which are externals not under my control and which have to do with the choices I actually control. Mm-hmm. Where then do I look for good and evil, not to uncontrollable externals, but within myself to the choices that are my own?
That is
knocking it out of the park.
What we were just talking about.
Knocking it out of the park.
Because I truly do believe that the solution to all things is... if you could somehow, by some miracle, get your self-esteem at 100%, where you liked everything about yourself, anything you heard to the contrary would just have no impact.
But let me ask you this. So just to play devil's advocate a little bit, do you think, is 100% acceptance of yourself healthy? Is 100% acceptance of yourself healthy because...
meaning like, oh, I decided I like that I fart on trains.
Well,
like,
just...
is that where you're going?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Just be a slovenly asshole.
Well, it's but just on trains. I don't know. It's weird. I just don't fart on
never
any other
in
forms
an elevator
of transportation. Nope, none other. You put me on a forklift. No,
fine.
Which is a form of transportation, I guess. Yeah. But
in a pinch.
But I just mean that just the idea that
you can't control. I don't know. What did you say right before that?
If you had 100% self-esteem.
Yeah, if you had 100% self-esteem, would you ever think that you needed to grow? Like, isn't it kind of good to be at about 80% with a 20% like constantly something to sort of work on? Or is that just an addict mentality?
I think it's an addict mentality, and also assumes that our nature is to be terrible, you know, or to not grow or to not desire change. Just because you have 100% self-esteem does not mean you're not still on fire for new thoughts. It doesn't mean you think your line of thinking is you've now figured it out, and that's a wrap on that for life.
Now, Marcus Aurelius once said, I'm just weaving this right into conversation.
Beautiful.
It's like, never ceases. He says, it never ceases to amaze me. We all love ourselves more than other people, but care more about their opinion than our own.
100%. And I'll flip that too. And this is something I just said in a meeting the other day.
And reverse it.
Put your damn thing on reverse. The opposite of that is, and I have to police myself on this all the time, is I often remind myself, oh my God, you would never talk to a stranger the way you're talking to yourself.
Absolutely.
That seems so simple, but if you really pay attention to the shit you say to yourself and how fucking cruel we can be to ourselves, and just imagine that you're having that same reaction to some guy who's just been vulnerable and humble about a failing or a shortcoming. You would never go, you fucking piece of shit, I knew this was coming, you're a waste of skin. No, you're a human. It's hard to do things right.
And I think people forget that they do choose, like, self-talk is a learned, like, I think sometimes the voice that's in, like, the voice that sort of self-talk in people's heads, they just think is programmed. It's like, well, it's the pre-programmed, prepackaged software. Can't do anything about it. It's just got a lot of bad pop-up ads, you know.
That's true.
Like Windows in, you know, 2001.
Yeah, you almost feel like that voice in your head is someone else's that you have no control over.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're creating the thoughts.
Yes, you are. So to realize that you actually can redirect the self-talk. I mean, it's not, you know, sometimes it's easier than other times because we're emotional creatures and we are hurt and, you know, like
My argument is the times it's hard is when your self-esteem is in the toilet. And when you feel great, it's not hard to silence that critic.
But it's – I notice you're in pretty good shape, so I imagine you exercise.
I do.
So you know – I think Muhammad Ali had a quote.
Oh, my God. This is amazing.
But I'm going to butcher this one.
Float like a butterfly and sting like a bee.
So it was it had something – it was something in the neighborhood of like, you know, he does sit-ups to the point where they start hurting and then he starts counting because you know that the muscle is being built when you're starting to feel it. At times of discomfort, that's when the muscle is being built. It's easy to go in and work out when you feel great and you've been eating great and everything's fantastic. God, this is easy. But the ones that count are when you feel shitty. You don't want to be there. You force yourself to go anyway. You push through it. That's where the growth happens. That's where, you know, like seeking, not going out of your way to seek discomfort, but just knowing that when you are uncomfortable, when you feel bad, when things happen, those are the opportunities for when the most muscle happens, the growth happens.
You just reminded me of, and I'm going to name drop right now. I'm not friends with him. I just happened to be somewhere. I got to talk to him for a while. But Matthew McConaughey, I just said to him, man, you have some constitution, don't you? I'm like, it appears to me that you party successfully, and yet you wake up in the morning, you like run 12 miles. And he goes, oh, yeah, some of my best workouts are breaking through. I'm feeling like shit that first 40 minutes and then just break through. Those are my best workouts.
Did you tell the story just to drop the impersonation? It was pretty solid work.
It was spot on what you were just saying. That it's easy to go when you feel great.
Yeah.
But it's hard. And I just thought.
So he creates the conditions to feel shitty.
This guy, what a fucking constitution. And that he actually gets high off that. Like the worse he feels and then he breaks through and that's his thing.
And at what point were you like, so I do a podcast and I really like.
You have yet to do that in real life. My wife's great at that for me. Thank God.
Oh,
The guests that you are jealous that I've gotten, you shouldn't be jealous of me. You should be jealous of Kristen Bell. She'll just be
she's the soul of the podcast.
She truly,
and who's going to say no to Kristen Bell?
Nobody.
Not one person.
Yes, and I can't ask people to do. You're one of maybe 9 people of 70 that I've directly asked.
I mean, you want to talk about Disney collectibles, you have an original edition Kristen Bell.
That's right. I do. But even and you, I only asked you because I'm like, okay, I've done his 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
I don't feel too guilty asking him to do mine. But
no.
I need that. I need that. I need something like that. It's very, very hard for me to ask.
But, you know, but now, like, you're at a point where you won't, you don't really have to ask anymore. I imagine people are pitching themselves. People are being pitched to you.
That's
so.
Happening. And then just, like, I find out through Twitter that some, like, Lena Dunham loves the show, which is awesome. And then if they love the show, then, of course, then I'm like, well, why don't you come on if you like it?
And also because people feel safe with you because they know that you are basically a peer. And you're not there to make them look bad, and they want to be able – I do believe, and I think part of the reason why podcasting works so well is that most people really do want to be heard and understood, and a lot of performers are not – before podcasts were just not given the chance because
yes.
they just did junkets. And it's like, yeah,
well,
I'm not –
the format, yeah, never has lent itself.
Yeah,
to.
I'm not just a – you know, I'm not just a – well, I guess I am a repetitive monkey, but I'm a more complicated monkey.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I want to share these complicated monkey issues that I have.
Yeah. There's also a thing on mine, I think, a little bit, which is I'm saying horrendous stuff about myself. And I seemingly haven't gone up in flames. So I think I'm setting the bar in a weird spot for the guests.
Right.
Where like, okay, well, I am going to admit something, which I wouldn't normally admit, but it's not nearly as bad as what he just admitted.
Right.
I think there's some kind of weird safety in that.
Well, of course, because again, people, it's a sharing session. I don't think people feel like, you know, and it's why sort of early on in the podcast, you know, before the people who didn't want to listen fell away and then the people who were going to listen, they were like, I don't give a shit about stories about yourself. You're a fucking ego. And I go, yes, of course. Yes, I do have an ego and I appreciate what you're saying. But the truth of the matter is it does – like when you share things about yourself, other people open up.
You have to
up.
Meet people halfway.
Yes, because then –
and I'm not going to edit out my side of it and then just act like they just jumped to some crazy –
you're just taking from someone. It's like you're taking from someone else. And a conversation, people need to feel like you're contributing so that they feel safe. And so they go, oh, I can relate to that. And here's my experience. And
yes.
so that it's not – you're not just using them to get, you know, a story or attention or whatever.
Well, early on, I did get some blowback on Twitter and stuff from people saying,
which is where most of the blowback happens in the world. That's where the blowback is kept.
Rename it to
blowback.
I was blowbacking, which would be like tweeting. Yeah, I was blowbacking. People said like, you know, shut the fuck up and let your guests talk. And then I thought, you know what? This is really maybe a failing on my part, which is I just need to be at ultra clear. This isn't an interview. You're listening to a conversation with me and people, and I'm going to converse, and you're going to hear about me. It's not
– And if you
Letterman.
Don't like that,
it's,
then there's a plenty
Letterman.
Of other podcasts.
There's so many things.
But I will say in their defense, there was a happy medium where a lot of those early shows I did talk way too much because I was terrified of silence.
Yeah.
And it took a while to get comfortable. So they were right –
Yes.
Some, and then I was right, some. But there was I think there was a happy medium where we kind of figured it out.
I agree. I'm still inching closer to the right amount.
Reminds me when I was a kid and I – that's how the podcast ends. I just talked
about
15
minutes.
Well,
you also start becoming aware of all your bad habits as you do more and more podcasts, and which is what I've now – and it's what's funny is it's something that used to irritate me about Howard Stern, who's my absolute favorite in the whole space. He's my hero. I would get frustrated when he would – he gets jealous as a person, admittedly. And so every actor he'd have on, he'd be like, well, didn't it just make you so jealous when you didn't do that role and that person did it and they got an award like that? Because that's where his mind goes.
Mm-hmm.
And when they would say, no, I didn't get jealous, he almost can't believe it and goes back for a third and fourth run at it. And I have now come to realize I do project a ton.
Because I'm trapped in my own perspective. So if someone says something that would be triggering to me, of course I'm like, well, didn't that piss you off? Or didn't that trigger, you know? So, you know, there are these bad habits I'm becoming more and more aware of. But at the same time, another voice in my head goes, the goal should not be for you to be perfect at this. The goal should be whatever you are.
I think a podcast is interesting when there's a journey. And there's a journey, you know, for those of us, especially, you know, those of us who've been through sobriety and are constantly like, I got to get better. I got to improve.
Yeah.
There is a journey of self-discovery that I think is sort of fun to listen in on, you know. And I definitely think that if like evolving with the podcast, you know.
Let's say minimally that you do have to evolve because you can't listen to the same thing endlessly. If it never evolves, and you even look at Stern, like, you know, my wife wouldn't even give him a chance because there, of course, was a period in his career where he threw bologna at girls' asses. So she was out, understandably right. So. If you listen to the show
Hey, my
now,
eyes are up here. Throw bologna at my eyes. Is that not?
That would be the respectful thing to do, is to throw bologna at the female's eyes. I mean, maybe that's just all she was mad about, was the area it was being thrown at.
But I understand what
now,
you're saying.
But now, I mean, there's so little of that now. And I think it was the smartest thing he could have ever done is to not get locked. Because it would have been very easy for him to go, well, no, my audience likes that. So I'll lose them if I evolve past that. Never thinking, which was then proven to be true, is that those audience members are also getting older and they're evolving and their taste is changing.
Well,
it would be fraudulent or dishonest to deny how you're evolving.
But also, yes, it's just – and again, that's just sort of being aware of where you are.
And that happens in real life. Like people regularly are confronted with evolving out of friendships, evolving towards other friendships, evolving out of relationships. Like it's not a thing that's just happening – professionally, it's like it's a part of life, is that you change and grow, and unfortunately often the elements around you have to reflect that.
Yeah, and it can be uncomfortable. Like
for
change
sure.
And growth can be uncomfortable. It's like
it's
there's a reason, you know, like it's called growing pains. It's not called growing pleasures.
Growing boners.
You're growing boners, which was a great sitcom.
What kind of mixes growing pains? And wasn't there a character named Boner on Growing Pains?
Yes, 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 yes. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. It was growing
pains. Maybe that was a working title for
it. It was
a
working title. That was a spinoff. So what are you...
Can I ask you one more question?
You can ask me anything.
What are
you
watching right now?
Let's see. What are we watching? Well, obviously, Walking Dead. Are we watching shows? Oh, we watched Haunting of Hill House, which was great.
Oh, because you like horror.
Yeah, we love horror.
Did you watch Castle Rock?
We watched Castle Rock. Uh-huh.
I'm not a horror person, but I got into that one.
Yeah, Castle Rock was really fun. And I watch Cheers every night. You know, there's 11 seasons.
3
and the show never dips. It starts amazing and continues to be amazing the entire time.
For me, that and Seinfeld are kind of the unicorns of like, I don't understand how you keep that quality.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a perfect concert of just like the writing, the directing, the acting, like everything about it. Just.
Well, yeah. You happen to in one project have the best multicam director of all time, Jimmy Burrows, with one of the most charismatic leads of all time, Sam Malone.
And everyone's great. And again, Ted Danson, and I have to tell you that a lot of people that I know are saying, you have to watch The Good Place. It's the fucking best show on television.
Oh,
people,
yeah.
The showrunner for Walking Dead, Angela Kang, we were talking about what we watched.
Uh-huh.
She was like, I fucking love The Good Place. She goes, it's just such an amazing show. And so...
Well, even for me, who watches it, of course, every Thursday when it comes on with my wife, what impresses me most is the storytelling. Like, Mike Schur is a smart motherfucker, as is that staff of writers. So even if it's not... Even when it's not my brand of humor, per se... You have to admire
farting on trains.
Story talent. Yes, yes.
Even when they're not farting on trains.
Fart on trains. I keep waiting. They've been on many trains in the show.
Not one fart.
Not one fart. But Yeah, the complexity of the story is well, you know, it's very, very rare that a comedy is serialized and that you are actually dying to find out what happens in the next episode. I can only think of two or three that are like that. Like Last Man on Earth, I loved. Did you watch that show?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And I found myself going like, oh, I can't believe I want to watch the next episode as badly as I wanted to watch an episode of Breaking Bad or something. Like they've somehow infused that cliffhangery thing with comedy, which is fun.
So what are you watching besides
We just started Handmaid's Tale, which we were late on.
Yep.
Because I had watched the pilot, and it wasn't for me, I didn't think. It was just so bleak. Have you watched it?
I was out of town, and Lydia watched it without me. Like and cheating. I got home, and she was like, I already watched it. I'm like, fuck. And so now, you know, I feel like I'll have to watch it alone.
It's incredible.
I've not heard one bad thing about it.
It's really incredible in the way that they are subversively tackling a couple of huge modern-day issues is pretty impressive.
Yeah. So
both with like kind of misogyny and they trick you into understanding what it's like to be a refugee. It's really powerful.
So I'll have to watch. I'll definitely.
You got to watch it. Yeah, and get to the third episode. For me, that's where it like took off.
We watch Baskets.
Okay.
Which is great. What else?
Last Chance You. Do you watch that show on Netflix? Oh. So the first two seasons, it's about a junior college, the first two seasons in Mississippi, where these extraordinary football players who have had really bad personal issues that have been kicked out of like top tier colleges, and this is their second chance. If they don't do well here and graduate from this junior college, their football dreams are over.
There's a sports element. And I'm
not into football. It's so personal, these kids. It's so heartfelt and amazing, and you can't not like it. And then the third season, which I watched a couple episodes of, and I was like, it's a different school altogether in a different state. I'm like, I don't like it. I liked all the old people. And then my brother just recently was like, you got to stick with it. And then I committed, and now I'm like, I can't eat them fast enough.
That's what's mind-blowing to me about Netflix is that we'll find a series like, you know, Hanger Town. We're like, what the fuck is Hanger Town? Season five. Where the fuck are these shows being made? You know, it's like there's so many shows that are like five seasons in that I have never heard of before.
Well, the thing I feel guilty about regularly, Monica and I were just talking about this, is because there's such a glut of amazing shows that I'm such a Fairweather fan now. It used to be like when there was only The Sopranos, of course I'd get through three bad episodes to get to a good one, because what else was I going to do?
Right.
But I watched like the first season of Mr. Robot, loved it. I got two-thirds of the way through the second season, first episode. I'm like, I'm out. That's it for me. I don't like the show anymore. I pulled the ripcord, and I've done that on like four or five shows that I loved the first season or the second season or whatever. And boy, if you lose me in one episode, I feel very shallow about it.
You know, we're spoiled now, and anything that's not the most pleasurable thing to us in any given moment, we can just go find the most.
That's
we're basically just in a giant candy store. Like, nah, this thing lost its flavor. I'm going to go over here to the Sour Patch Kids.
100%. I feel like a Fairweather sports fan. You know, one bad game and I'm out.
Well, new team. Got to get a new team.
Yeah. They suck this year.
No, it's just one bad game.
No, they suck.
This entire year. I don't know. It was a little extreme. So what else are you promoting besides Armchair Expert? You're promoting Farts on a Train.
I'm always pro Farts on a Train. I'm on the ranch on Netflix. I come in midway through that series, and I think I filmed a while ago, but I think they're about to come out now. And they come out in blocks. I've never been on a Netflix show, so it's very interesting to know that you'll come out and like they could have seen the whole thing in an afternoon.
Oh yeah,
yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah,
and then I have a game show. That's what I want to talk about. We have the same boss.
Oh yeah, Andrew Glassman.
Yes, I love
one of the nicest men in television.
Truly. I must have said this five times a day. I've never in my life had a nicer boss.
So with People on the Wall, he stays in contact with all the contestants.
Yes.
He checks in. He makes sure they're okay. He wants to make sure they feel supported if they didn't win. Because we'll have conversations and I'll say, I was gutted that this one couple didn't win. He goes, I've been speaking to them.
Uh-huh.
They're doing fine.
Yes.
You know, like this thing happened. They're happy. Like they're good. You know, like, and I'm so impressed by how much he.
Well, and by the way, this is a second time. Again, it's
so hard for me to ask for advice. And weirdly, I've asked you for advice twice this year.
Yeah.
You're in a very rare category of people I've asked advice from, because I'm such a know-it-all. But yeah, because I got approached to do his show, Spin the Wheel, which I did, which I think comes out in January on Fox. A game show like yours, preposterously huge scale.
Right.
You know, like a five-story spinning wheel. You can win $22 million, the whole thing. And I called you and I said, you know, should I do this? What do you think of this? And you walked me through all the pros and cons of it. And, you know, it was very helpful. And you had warned me it can get heartbreaking.
Like, yeah.
And boy, is that true.
Yeah.
I mean, because you spend 2.5 hours with people in this crazy heightened state. And they're only bringing you people that are 20 times better than you are as
a person. Of course.
I mean, yeah. Literally this guy like was driving down the road. There's a train crashed on an overpass. He crawls through the train and pulls out 22 people. And now I'm next to him and I'm like, I'm a piece of shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? I do think fast. That's my entire contribution to the planet Earth is I think fast.
I'm charmingly arrogant. That's my superpower.
And yeah. You actually have a superpower. Yes.
And so, yeah, when you're with these people and it's getting so close to them either winning this fortune that's going to change their life or not, hey boy, it's a ride.
Yeah, and also, you know, just remembering that they're people, like they're humans, and you can talk to them and it doesn't have to be like, let's see what's behind them. You know, like you can actually just talk to them like people and learn. I love doing the wall because I love learning from people, like you said, who are 20 times better than I am.
Yeah.
And trying to absorb their positive energy.
And mine's almost always it's even rooted in evil, which is like, I'm so cynical. I'm like, what kind of person would do this extraordinary thing? My first thought is, well, they've killed somebody and they want to repent.
I think it's, you know, I think that's where we differ because I'm definitely not cynical in that way. And I'm
a misanthrope and you are not.
And
that's the defining difference.
It makes me happy. And also, you know, it's nice when the world feels so toxic out there again.
I almost feel like I have appropriate expectations and yours are high and you're let down by humanity. I'm shocked when someone does the right thing and you're like, yes, of course, that's what they should do.
And I'm shocked when people do horrible things because it's inconceivable. Like if someone says something really horrible, it's like, why would you say that to a person? Yeah. You know, like it.
And I go, oh yeah, that's what people say.
People do. Yeah.
He did exactly what I expected.
And I do the exact opposite. I'm like, I don't understand.
Yeah. So I wonder if the result of it though is.
I'm also like trustworthy to a fault. It's really easy to pull shit over on me because I just believe people when they tell me things.
Yeah,
and it's very easy to lie to me because I go, well, they said, you know, like, so why would they do something that's not what they said? You know, like,
right,
so
right.
I don't know. I mean, it's, I guess there's pros and cons to both. Maybe what we need to do is come together like the alien station from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And we'll just find, like, we're the perfect co-pilots.
Yeah, the yin and yang.
Yeah, and then we smash together for the stereoscopic vision.
Right.
Because, you know, you're very cynical. And I'm like, yeah, you
know,
Jack,
I'm still waiting for you to call me for advice. I guess you just haven't recognized my genius yet.
Well, or maybe I've been digging it out of you this entire time. And I just didn't say
something tells me
advice.
When you have kids, I might get a call from you. It's a never-ending lesson in flexibility.
So your podcast is crushing right now, and you have all these amazing things coming up. I'm excited to see I'm excited to see the show that you did with Andrew for Fox, right?
It's yeah,
Fox.
And let me just, again, if I wasn't clear enough, I love you, Andrew, and you are the sweetest boss I ever had, and I wish you were my boss on all things. I really mean that. I love that guy.
Yeah, he's the real deal.
Our lives are becoming so paralleled. It's really ridiculous. Because how many people have a big event game show they host? It's a very select few people.
Well,
we're doing almost the exact same things.
You still have to do an after show for a scripted drama.
Okay, I'll do it.
And
I just gotta find one that. I mean, you want to talk about a fucking niche? I mean, what?
You gotta
niche.
Host the Better Place, which is the Good Place after show.
where, or The Bad Place.
The Bad Place. Yeah. I think I'd most You'd appropriately host the bad be place. The host of, yeah. I think if people saw me as the face of The Better Place when Ted and Kristen are the
Bad Place.
Yeah.
The Bad Place.
Yeah. Me and Adam could host that.
Well, thanks for coming over.
Yeah.
I mean, you live very close. We never really get to hang out. Never. It's dumb because we could walk to each other's houses.
Sincerely, there's no easier appointment to keep for either of us than one another's podcast because they're within 1,000 feet.
And let me tell you, I appreciate that you were on time because sometimes when things are really close, it's easier to be late.
I am most late to things I'm closest to. Because I'll be on the like right now I'm shooting The Ranch. It's at Netflix. Netflix is 8 blocks from my house. So I'll literally be on the toilet and what are we calling it? Blowback. On blowback. Looking at the time and I'm like, all right, 9:58. I have to be there at 10. I'm still looking great. And I'm mid-dump.
How are you 20 minutes late? You live.
I'm like, I'm golden. I can get to work in 2 minutes.
And in reference to blowback, I believe it was Cato who said, I begin to speak only when I'm certain what I'll say isn't better left unsaid.
Oh.
A delightful way.
Thank you for sending me home on that. I'm going to take the Badger.
Yeah, you can take the...
I'll return it after the holidays.
Yeah, please do. Take home a holiday.
I think that guy's begging to have a wreath around his neck.
He wants a wreath, and he wants like a ham leg. And I think
I was going to say, you should do a wreath, and in the wreath are like severed fingers and stuff.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Because that's what he wants to eat, your fingers.
Lydia probably ordered something like that on the internet. We do have a Halloween tree that she puts up, so there is probably a severed finger wreath.
Yeah. I'm glad you kept her hidden from me, by the way. That was smart.
She's not here.
Well, so you say.
Yeah.
She's with Miskevich's wife. So. All right, Hardwick, I love you.
All right, Dex.
That was the ID10T podcast number 1035 with Dax Shepard going up extraordinarily late. Which, of course, I explained in the beginning of the podcast. It's time for Idiot Rap. ID10T Rap. I'm going to settle on a name. It's going to happen. I'm just going to start calling it something, and then that's ultimately what it's going to be. I'm fighting a cold. I'm on the edge of that holiday seasonal cold. Guys, do you know it's dropped down all the way to 53 degrees in Los Angeles? How does anyone survive such extreme temperature changes? I know, we have no resistance to weather elements here in LA, so I acknowledge this, but I also say, like, it does feel cold as fuck here. Anyway, Dax and I were talking about how when someone says something shitty to you, how a lot of times we choose to be hurt by things, we choose to feel bad about stuff. And I thought it was an interesting point to clarify. Also because, you know, look, there are certainly extreme situations. I mean, if someone comes up to you and is like, you're a dumb piece of shit and everything you do is failure and fuck you and fuck your family, of course that's going to make you feel bad. You would have to be made of rock for that not to make you feel bad. Or, you know, if someone steals your dog, yes, you're going to feel bad about that. There are certainly instances where you're going to feel bad. So I don't think the idea is like, you can choose to never feel bad about anything. I don't think that's very realistic. I think we're sort of just talking in general terms about, you know, a lot of things that stick in our brain that we kind of beat ourselves up about. So I do want to talk about just sort of in general, like, well, what do you do when, you know, something really bad happens and you feel bad about it? I've been enjoying this a subreddit, which is r mindfulness, which is exactly what it is. It's just sort of mindfulness. And I throw it in there with my get motivated and stoicism and all the fun brain ones and that I read on Reddit. But I really sort of like the idea, and you see this theme recur a lot in mindfulness, which is, you know, rather than fighting the feelings that you're having, you acknowledge them and you sit in them and then you allow them to pass. Sort of like what Kristen Bell was talking about last week, where she allows her kids she allows them to sort of sit in their embarrassment for a minute and then move on. Like, okay, we had that moment. Now everything's okay. You learn from it. So in those moments where someone steals your dog or someone says the worst things imaginable to you or something, you know, like really bad happens, you know, it's over the long haul, over the long term, trying to make choices that don't let you sit in it as long, you know, over the weeks and months and years. Because, you know, like, shitty things like that can replay in your head over and over and over again. And so maybe it's allowing it to happen, allowing it to pass, and then when it keeps trying to come back and make you feel bad, just choosing to have other thoughts or move your focus elsewhere. I was having lunch with a friend of mine a couple of days ago, and he said something so brilliant. He's a bit older. He's in his 70s, so he's got some wisdom under his belt. And he said to me, never put a period at the end of a negative sentence. And I just thought that completely changed my outlook. Because he said, when you put a period at the end of a negative sentence, negative self-talk, then it's a thing that your brain can sort of build an argument around. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. When you kind of have a negative self-talk thing and you put a period on the end, the period sort of makes it definitive and then it starts to solidify. When it starts to solidify, your brain starts giving you all these examples to justify that sentence. So maybe just don't put a period on these things. You know, when you have bad feelings, you can feel them, you know, you can feel them and it's natural to feel them. No, it's not gonna last forever. No, there's not a period on the end of it. And when it starts to go on, then maybe just try choosing to think about something else, choosing to have a different spin on it, choosing to see, like, what did I learn from this? You know, I mean, obviously there are extreme situations. It's not always going to work maybe in every situation, and that's okay too. But I'm just trying to give you as many little inspirational tools as I can so that, you know, at least you can cut out a percentage of the negativity you might be experiencing between your ears. So that is it for today. As always, I appreciate you. I hope you're navigating the weather changes in your region. Seriously, like the rest of the... I do feel bad complaining about 53-degree weather. Like the rest of the country is really is like an ice forest right now. So, but I hope you're well. I hope you're safe. I do appreciate you. And I will see you in your ears real soon.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.